This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sephora stores are everywhere you are, so just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope that it's successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to our podcast by the New Books Network. I'm your host, Fulya Pınar. I'm here today with Gil Hochberg to talk about her book, Becoming Palestine, Toward an Archival Imagination of the Future, published by the Duke University Press in 2021. Thank you very much, Gil, for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Fulya. Very happy to be here.
So at the New Books Network, we'd like to start with learning about our guests' backgrounds. So could you tell us about your background, your biography?
Sure. Well, it's always a little bit difficult to know where to start, but why don't I start from the end and go backwards. So I am currently I'm currently a professor and chair of the Department of Middle East, South Asia, and African Studies at Columbia University. And I've been here from 2017. And before that, I was a professor of comparative literature for 15 years at UCLA in Los Angeles. And before that, I did my PhD in comparative literature at UC Berkeley. And that was from 1995 to 2002. So that's my academic background. In terms of my more personal or, you know, background, I was born in the U.S., actually in North Carolina, in Chapel Hill. But I spent most of my life before I went to Berkeley at Israel. That's where I grew up and went to school, and also did my BA and my MA. So I would say that at this point of my life, I've lived most of my life, the beginning of it, and then from 25 on in the U.S. But then in between, I lived in Israel. So that's sort of my background. And the background, I'm sure this will come up later on in our conversation, but it's in many ways my work, which focuses on Palestine and Israel, does very closely relate to my personal, life. I don't really sort of have that distinction between the personal and the political, or the activism part of my life and my academic part of my life. They're all one, for better or worse.
Yeah, thank you for sharing. And your career sounds very impressive too, I must say. So let's talk about the book, but as you mentioned, this is a very interesting book, not only because it's content, but also because in the preface, you mentioned that while completing this book, you have actually realized that this book was indeed maybe a third installation of a trilogy about Palestine, as you had two previous books about the past and present, and this one is about the futures. So could you tell us about this rather unplanned but sequential order of your three books on Palestine and this book's position among them? And you just mentioned that these all relate to your personal history too. So maybe if you could tell us a bit about this like sequence and this position.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about it, because indeed, you know, somebody might think that I, of course, planned it and then just said that I didn't plan it, but I really didn't plan it. And it did, it became a trilogy, or I realized it was a trilogy, and it's really took me by surprise. So let me just give a little bit of background in terms of the previous books. So the first book I published is called In Spite of Partition, and it came out in 2007 with Princeton Press. That book, which was a revision, quite a radical revision of my dissertation, but it was a work that really is preoccupied with the figure that I, at the time and still, call the figure of the Arab Jew, by which I don't mean just the particular individuals who happen to be both Arabs and Jews, or Mizrahi, as some people call them, but the kind of crossword of identities, or these names, Arab and Jew. And the book focuses, that book focuses on literature written in Hebrew, in Arabic, and in French. And it is sort of what it tries to do is traces these figure, the figure of the quote-unquote Arab and the figure of the quote-unquote Jew and the intersections between them. And my argument in that book is that there is actually a literary imagination, a very lively literary imagination, in which the partition that has taken place at least since 1948 with the establishment of Israel on the historical land of Palestine, the partition between the imaginary division of Jew on one side, Arab on the other side, or Palestinian on one side, Jew on the other side, or Israeli on the other side, that there is actually a literary imagination, a vast living literary imagination that rejects that by returning us to the to a lively past in which this partition didn't exist. And that was this, that was that project. The next book that I wrote, which is called A Visual Occupation. And Visual Occupations is a book about violence and visibility in a conflict zone. And that second book, well, first of all, it moves from mostly literature to mostly, not all, but mostly visual, meaning film, photography, and visual art. But the, I would say that the temporal move was really the main one, because it's a book that doesn't read for a legacy or a history. It was a book that was really, it was written, it came out in 2015, but I wrote it between 2010 to 2014. And I traveled several times to Palestine and Israel. I lived for a short while in Abu Dis, which is basically not Israel nor Palestine, because it's this enclave between the West Bank and the border of quote-unquote proper Jerusalem. So it's not East Jerusalem, it's not West Bank, it's this, you know, no man's land. But during that period, I moved mostly across. So I, in a way, I revisited the question of partition, because I was physically moving across in and out of the West Bank, in and out of East Jerusalem and West Jerusalem, in and out of Tel Aviv and Jaffa, etc., and kind of wanting to experience that mobility, while also acknowledging that different bodies and different identity cards allow for very, very different movements across those particular borders in this land. So in a way, this second book, which came out at Duke Press in 2015, is a book that I see mapping out a kind of a visual politics of the present. It's much darker than the first book in the sense that it's not sort of reviving a hopeful past. It is a much more dark and realistic look at the inequalities that have to do with the division of what I call the visual field in Israel and Palestine. Who sees what, who sees who, and mostly who doesn't get to be seen and whose vision is restricted. And so that was that project. And it really was only when I completely finished, in fact, very close to the state of the proofs of Becoming Palestine, this current book, that it suddenly occurred to me that this book, Becoming Palestine, is about primarily a becoming and a futurity and potentiality, and in that sense, really about the future. And that's where I sort of realized that there really is a trilogy here. Now, when I say there is a trilogy, I don't just mean, oh, one is about the past, one is about the present, one is about the future, but also that I think, and then maybe that, Fulya, maybe that ties back to your question about relating it, you know, to my own kind of self or political self, let's call it. And that's because I think that I moved from a kind of position as a scholar, but also really as somebody who's very involved in activism with relation to Palestine and my own sort of political views and inspirations and associations. And I think I myself also went through a kind of process of and I think it's not only mine, I think it's pretty common for this to happen, of some kind of investment in the past as a source of hope, nostalgia, you could call it, but, you know, looking for a history and where you can find alternative models for a reality that is oppressive and deserves to be changed or ought to be changed as soon as possible, to then moving in the second book to a kind of maybe a harsh awakening. You know, this was after, in 2014, the very, very massive and unforgettable attack, merciless attack on Gaza in 2014. So a very sort of sober, pessimistic look at how does this system work? How is it that this actually functions, that this kind of monstrosity functions? And that's what the second book looks like. It looks at, really, it really does look at, particularly for me, what are the visual politics and the visual infrastructure that allows for the machine to work. It's not just, you know, there's a group of some mind masters and then everybody just follows and it works. No, you know, you have to have certain system. And it's a very Foucauldian book in that sense, that it really does sort of assume that there is a particular politics of vision, and that's what allows and sustains this the situation in Palestine as a situation of an ongoing military and violent, very violent oppression and occupation. And then I think two things happened. One is I became increasingly more interested in visual arts. I've always been interested in film and in photography, but I became really more interested in sort of and more equated with art that is less mainstreamy, perhaps. You could call it, you know, sort of like a more avant-garde in some ways. You know, kind of a circulates in Biennale, perhaps, but not really massively circulates. And I've started, so in a way, I've started to notice something, and I think that what I've noticed also met a need that I had, which was a need for finding some kind of ability to hope for change. And when I started to recognize that there is a whole body of works that I didn't, you know, just, I didn't cram them in and created a book. I went through a long process of following many artists, mostly Palestinians, and realizing through my own interaction that there is something, some kind of a trend that I was slowly becoming clear to me. And that trend was what I call this trend of becoming. This idea that there is a past, there is a present, and there is potentiality. And how we arrive at that potentiality is a whole other question, and I'm sure we will get to talk about it, but that time, that temporality of the future is not fully just follows, it's not a cause and effect of past and present. It has its own logic. And that's what this book is really about. And I found hope that I don't think is a dreamy, sort of naive, over-optimistic hope. And I also think that all these artists that I are suggesting are working in this time of becoming share that. I don't think it's I think it's a very reasonable mode. But it's one that requires us to respect the time of potentiality and becoming.
Yeah. So let's talk more about some of these specific themes and arguments in your book, in Becoming Palestine. So let's talk about the archive. In the book, you challenge the quite common way of imagining the archive as this place where you just search for written documents, and with those documents you reveal some kind of a truth, the facts about the past, and this truth is in a hierarchically higher position than the other truths. So can you explain what is unproductive here politically in this kind of an imagination of the archive, and what kind of an archival imagination would you propose in this book as opposed to this rather unproductive one?
Right. So I'll answer this by first saying that I do have a general argument here, of course, an engagement in the introduction about archives as such. And the sense of the place that, as you said yourself, that archives tend to have, especially through the discipline of history, which is considered still today, has a different place, I believe, above many other disciplines in the humanities, is somehow closer to the truth. So I do make some claims about that. And in that sense, I would say that the book is, to put it very bluntly, it's anti-historical, but not anti-historical in the sense that I really think that, you know, it doesn't matter what happened. But I do think that the question of what happened or the narrative of what happened has to be placed alongside and not above other narratives, for example, about what could have happened or what can still happen. So that's my general argument. And then I would say that specifically in the context of Palestine and the place of archives in Palestine and what I call the question of Palestine as the question of the archive, I think we then hit some very specific issues which have to do with a kind of almost oversaturation of archives and over-reliance on the archive. And what I mean by it is that because Palestine, as Edward Said has told us, is a place that first and foremost is a question, right? The question of Palestine. And because there is a question here, not only about the matter of land ownership or about national self-determination, but also a question of narrative and who, what narrative is told. And because of that, there has been a very vivid and justifiable attempt to revive various archives that generate an alternative to the main dominant Zionist narrative, which has been a leading source of narrative in the West, but not only in the West, and much of it thanks to the production of archives and the destruction of many of the Palestinian archives. So many, many important and important projects have been made thanks to this kind of work. So when I say we need to go beyond the frenzy of finding historical documents in the archive, I do not dismiss that. What I do say, however, is that at this point and in this context, there is nothing left to be found. And that, in fact, the idea that anything still needs to be proven through history is in itself politically offensive and unproductive, because there is a limit to how many times an atrocity needs to be proven, and that the efforts actually need to move to a different place. So that's sort of my main critique here. And then what I do suggest is that there is a different logic that one can find in what I call archives for the future, which is the production of archives as a means of discovering the present. Or another way to say it is to say that the present itself is the archive, and that we need to approach the present as an archive rather than stop the present and, you know, to be literal, go to the basement and look for proofs in the archive.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and in terms of temporality, and before delving deeper to the book, so for our audience, can you explain what becoming means in your work? And maybe more importantly, what becoming entails when it's used together with Palestine?
Yes, absolutely. So in the most general term, I use the term becoming, and I follow in that the work of Deleuze, the French philosopher, who himself makes a distinction, which I find very, very productive, between history or historical investigation and becoming as a kind of a political project that has to do not so much with what has been actualized, but what can still become beyond the scope of history. And so when I turn to becoming, what I'm trying to suggest is that there is a reality that we know, and we know enough about it to know that there are two entities. They're called Israel and Palestine. Some people call it only Palestine. Some people call it historical Palestine. Some people call it only Israel. We know all of that. And we know that there are different narratives about how these entities came about before and after 1948. The question is, what does it mean to think about becoming Palestine? What does it mean about thinking about a kind of becoming that we can still imagine as an alternative reality? And I call it becoming Palestine. And the question would be then, which I presume would be your following question, why becoming Palestine necessarily? And for this, I guess what I want to explain to listeners is that becoming Palestine is a kind of futurity that I can elaborate more through the works of art that I trace, but it's a kind of futurity that I envision not as a becoming or going backwards, not let's go back to pre-1948 and reestablish a Palestine that either was or wasn't, and we can continue to argue about it. But it definitely is a becoming that will come out of what isn't now, meaning it is not the current reality of partition, it is not the current reality of occupation, it is not Israel. It is a becoming of something that we cannot fully describe, and we must not fully describe because we don't have the words to fully describe what is that will become, but we can trace it as a potentiality. And the details of that potentiality I really find in the various artworks that I analyze.
Yeah, and this was going to be my next question. So in the book, you show how artists, filmmakers, writers reimagine the very archive itself by engaging with, making, remaking plural archives. So can you tell us a bit about the relationship between becoming and this future-oriented archival imagination? And what role does art play here for you?
Yes, thank you. So I would say first, I'll start with the end, that art plays a very, very central point for me, and that I'm very blunt and open about it, that, you know, some could say that, you know, it's a very modernist book in that sense, because I really do hold to a certain belief in art. And I do think that, you know, if people don't share that presupposition, they probably won't share many of my suggestions. But I do think that art has a potential to precisely explore places that history cannot explore. And that is this particular space of imagination, of becoming. And specifically, you're very right to suggest that I relate. I mean, I think you capture something very important when you say that the political work that I ascribe to the artworks that I look at does have to do with the creation of archive and the recirculation of archival material in new ways. And I would say that a very important term for me in this sense is citationality. I read the archive as a work of citation and recitation. And I think that's what I really find remarkably productive. And also I was surprised myself to find this happening in such different ways, very, very different ways, which is, I think, part of the beauty of reading these artworks together, is that each one of these artworks, which I think, or the various artworks and films, which I all think very, very highly of. And this is just a side note, that for me, the work is first and foremost a work of engaging with the art. And I say it in the book time and again, but I want to stress this, that I think that art thinks. So yes, I brought the arts together. Yes, I came up with an argument. And yes, I did my own reading. But I really do find the work of thinking in the art, and I'm thinking with it. I'm not, I'm a student of these artworks and these artists. I think that what's remarkable is that I ended up with very, very different works and very different mediums. I discuss dance, I discuss film, I discuss essay film, I discuss photography, literature, painting. But what I do find coming across all of them is this idea that when one finds an archive, and an archive could start with just a document, just a photograph, just a stone, one has then the option to reinscribe that particular finding in another context, or at the same time, and reinscribe the present moment on that, right? So say a wall that carries traces and marks, a wall in a building in Jaffa that cases traces and marks of the past, when reread into the current present setting and then reframed, say, in an essay film that brings together Israeli films with American films, but reinstalls figures that actually do not exist in the original footage, but are placed from the present moment on the desk of the director who is directing it at his desk in Berlin, you understand that you are then dealing with an archive in becoming. This is a living archive. This is an archive that makes itself and doesn't stop. It is not an archive that says, open this folder, you will find the answers, then close it and return to the present. A very different kind of archive. This is a breathing and living archive because it is an archive that, yes, it does, in some cases, even specifically returns to historical documents that are placed in even national archives, such as in the case of Jamana Mana's film, where she returns to the Israeli National Archive and specifically looks at particular archives and then revisits those archives through making her own film that has its own retracing of musical traces that are found in the original archive, and then she traces it in the present. So you already have two layers, two temporal layers on the same archive. I hope this is making sense.
Yeah, definitely. No, definitely. And the artist whose works you think with, like, as you mentioned, Jumana Menas, Kemal El Jafari's, Basil Abbas, Farah Salas. So all of their works, they show a diversion from the archive, but also using the archive, but to imagine a different potentiality, to imagine the otherwise, the yet to come, as you state in the book too. So these are very interesting, and there are some commonalities among them, of course, because they rewrite, expand, and change the archival imagination with almost a need, a desire to think about, to build new, alternative, different features. So maybe this is because you're such a good writer, but you also mentioned it. It seemed to me that your book derived from what these works meant for you, instead of you having a pre-established goal of your own while looking at these works. And considering that most of your analysis are on very recent contemporary works, so I was curious to know what these commonalities and the very existence of your book could tell us about this particular moment in time. So could you tell us if there's something specific about this moment in the Palestinian imaginative culture that seems to be bringing about this various works of these artists and your own book too?
Right. Thank you. No, that's a great question. You know, without sounding too generalized, I would say that I do think there is something that is very contemporary about this moment that is shared by all these artists and many others, Palestinian artists. And I think it has to do with a different position vis-a-vis what the role of the artist is, but not just the artist, even just what is the role of anybody who imagines and cares about Palestine, by which I mean at the very bare minimum reaching a level of political justice that that is long overdue. And I think that has to do with the fact that the difference is that there were many, many decades in which really there was one role, and that was, again, to turn to Edward Said, that was to claim the narrative, to make it be heard, to make Palestine visible, to make the narrative legitimable, you know, to make it noticeable, to make it be able to even not just compete, but even just exist in the face of the very, very, very powerful Zionist narrative. And I don't want to go back into why is it that the Zionist narrative is so, so strong. In fact, one of the chapters in the book, which talks about Larissa Sansour's sci-fi films, I think that Larissa's work actually engages with that, even though, you know, I don't think she would say, my work questions what it is. But I think there is a lot in her sci-fi work that actually does try to say that there it actually in some ways makes sense that the Zionist narrative has made so much progress, or so much, you know, had so much leg in it, not just because of the history that we all know of the Holocaust, etc., but also because of the very, very the specific historical conditions, but also because of a specific history that has to do with the place of the past, the present, the future, archaeology and theology, right? So I don't want to get into all of that, which may some of your listeners may know more about, some less, but in the face of a movement to quote-unquote bring Jews back to their promised land, in the face of a growing evangelist movement, in the face of a post-Holocaust world, in the face of a the strongest theological narrative that we still have, it's not a surprise that, you know, Zionism has succeeded, but it has because it had such a success. It has become an almost impossibility for Palestinians to make their narrative heard. And that was the case for a very, very, very long time. Some would argue it still is the case, but we have to acknowledge the fact that even the New York Times is now changed its reporting. Now, if the New York Times has changed its reporting, it means that, I'm not saying that people are listening to the Palestinian narratives, but it is no longer hidden. And I think in that sense, there's two things that happened. One, Palestinian artists, I think, don't think that it is their job anymore to simply prove that Palestinians exist, or simply prove that the Palestinian narrative has legs. Beyond that, I think that there is almost a rebellion against that idea. Again, it has to do with the question that I said at the beginning. How many times does the oppressed need to prove that they are oppressed? And I think that turning against that and turning into actually having the right to imagine and to think of the future, and also to create a different kind of art. Yes, I am going to sound very blunt, but yes, to have the right, and again, Larissa Sansour, I think, makes a very settled, but her iconography always makes a kind of ironic touch, because there is always a kind of an olive tree that she watered, that her character waters, or in her futuristic Palestine built in a closed building, you see the Al-Aqsa Dome. So I think in some ways, all of these artists are always also saying, we also have the right to imagine otherwise, to move on, and to open the space not just towards the past into proving time and again that one, we exist, two, we have suffered, three, we are rebelling, but no. There is a space that I call the right to imagine and the right to respect imagination. I think that's what is demanded in these works. And I think that, yes, times have changed and the world has changed in part in its growing recognition of the Palestinian cause. And I think many of these artists who, you know, for the most part are young and are also very, you know, they're international in the sense that they're in and out of the space of Palestine. And I think there is a strong desire to join the world in terms of I mean it in a level of a poetic joining those who have the right to dream, to have the right to have hope, to have the right to imagine.
Yeah, thank you. So I was also curious, and this will be a bit of a diversion from the content of the book, and it will be more like a speculation, but how do we protect an anti-colonial future-oriented archival imagination from potential appropriation or depoliticization by the colonizers, because they are often known with their capacity to appropriate, to contain, to depoliticize these radical engagements. So, I mean, of course, you don't have to respond to this because this is not like about the content of the book, but I was so curious about your opinion.
Yeah, you know, I haven't thought about it before, but I guess for me, appropriation is not a big fear, I would say, because, you know, appropriation, in order for appropriation to work, it really requires a real appropriation. And, you know, it's sort of like if the colonizer fully swallows the colonized, they'll have a stomach ache. And I don't think there is a way for the colonized out of it either. And I think that's a lot of actually what this work is trying to show and what some of these artists actually demonstrate. If you think of Kamal al-Jafari's project, you know, you have a Palestinian artist, a filmmaker, born, raised in Jaffa, who decides to make films about his hometown, but actually almost all the visual material he can find, if not all, photographs, films, cinematography, are from the Israeli cinematic archive or cinematography and American films, right? So the approach that he takes, I think, is one of devouring, or like, you know, you can call it, you know, a de-appropriation. He is, you know, so here is Jaffa fully appropriated, right? Not just appropriated as a city. In fact, the most extreme, I would say that the most extreme case is revealed when he describes the way in which in some of the American and Israeli films, not only they take place in Jaffa, and then the Palestinian residents are either evacuated or they're asked to, you know, serve as some background in the film. And other people, actors come in there, and that even, you know, whenever they need some kind of an American scene taking place in Beirut, it's easier to film in Israel. So they film it in Gaza and in Jaffa and say it's in Beirut. But of all of these, I think the most extreme case is the case in which the city itself is described in one of the American action films as actually bombed, in reality, bombing buildings in the city and then shooting it, right? So shooting the film, by bombing the buildings in the city. So I can't think of a more cruel and vicious type of cynical appropriation, right? A destruction of a city in order to appropriate it as a scene in American or Israeli film. But Al-Jafari's response to this is to actually return to those particular films, to those very films, and use those scenes in his own films. He makes his films by sort of, you know, tailoring scenes from these films. That's his last film, Recollection, is almost all made of these patching of these scene after scene from these appropriations, right? So in a way, what I argue in that film is that what he does by then also adding characters that he studied very well, from the characters that he scratches and find one missing Palestinian character in a window, or he finds a photo of his uncle and he places it inside the old film. So he places a film on top, a film on top of a film, re-inscribing what has been erased back into the archive. I think what you get here is a kind of archive of the present or the future that goes beyond the question of appropriation, because the appropriation is then reappropriated to a level where you can say that the citation and the citationality leaves the appropriator, the colonizer, at complete loss. Because there is absolutely, when I say, you know, if they swallow it up, they will have a stomachache, the ghosts come back and they hunt. And in Al-Jafari's films, they really sort of appear on the screen, right? So, yes, there is an appropriation, but it's not a timeless appropriation. It's there is a price to it. You know, it's going to be reappropriated and re-ascribed and recited, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that would be my answer, that appropriation can only be dangerous if we really think that it will stop at that act, right? That there will be, let's give the most blunt example. You know how if you go to a supermarket in the U.S., you get, what is it called? Like everything is called something Israeli, right? So you have Israeli salad, Israeli falafel, Israeli couscous, Israeli, you know. But it doesn't end there, right? I mean, that is an act of appropriation, but it's an act of appropriation that I think is not that remains very, very fragile. Or maybe I'm overtly optimistic here, but I don't think that at the end of the day, falafel will go down in history as an Israeli product.
Yeah, I think you're showing with examples in your great answer, by the way, thank you so much for it, that the power of imagining futures actually. So not imagining just things will end with appropriation, everything failed, not imagining like that, but still having this like circulation and still having this expansion sort of. Well, Gil, this conversation has been amazing for me and I really enjoyed the book. I'm sure our audience will love it as well, but we have taken a lot of your time. So let's talk about the projects that you're currently working on or you plan to work on.
Oh, thank you. At the moment, I am starting a project that I'm not sure yet where it will lend me to, but I feel that I have myself avoided, and I feel that many people continue to avoid the uncomfortable place of looking at the real role of the imagination of Christian evangelist theology in the current state of the Zionist project. I'm looking at some text, but mostly actually art, and looking at the role of this imagination. And I, you know, it's very, very early on, so I don't want to sort of overstate where I'm at with it. But I would say that it's really, my main argument is that it's not that, you know, once upon a time there was theology, it was in the 19th century, and now we're, you know, in this secular time, and we're really talking just about national conflict. It's far from it. It's, this reality is held by a long-lasting project that, you know, you can call it archaeology, you know, whatever you want, you know, finding remnants of the Second Temple, etc. But it is at core a Christian theological project, and it remains so. So that's my current project.
Wow. That sounds very interesting. We will certainly be looking forward to your next project.
That will take some time. That will take some time.
We will still be looking forward to this. Thank you so much, Gil, for your time, for joining us, for this amazing book, and for answering all these questions. And the pleasure is certainly mine to host you here. I'm your host, Fulya Pınar. This discussion of Becoming Palestine Toward an Archival Imagination of the Future, published by the Duke University Press in 2021, is brought to you by the New Books Network. Thank you so much for listening.